Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California's COVID test positivity rate is hovering around 16%. And that's just the people who get tested through a lab. Nowadays, many people are taking at-home tests, so the real number is likely to be severely undercounted. The surge in cases is thanks to new, highly contagious variants like BA5 and an even newer BA2.75. Hospitalizations in California are rising, but deaths remain low, thanks to vaccines, treatments, and therapeutics. So while COVID fatigue is real, the reality is it's still here. We're going to get a sense of where we are locally. I spoke with Dr. Amy Sisson, the public health officer for Yolo County. Dr. Sisson, you know, we brought you on to talk about BA5, and now there's BA2.75. Can you just lay out what these two variants are, what we know about them, and what concerns you most about what health officials like yourself are hearing about them?
Yeah, well, just to be clear, BA5 is what's here now. It became the dominant variant in Yolo County at the end of June. BA.2.75 is a variant that may be coming. It's been detected in India, and it's causing increased case rates there. It has been found in the United States. I think there's been a total of 10 cases identified in the United States. So it is not causing the current wave of cases here in the United States, in California, and in Yolo County. That is the unfortunate work of the BA.5 Omicron subvariant.
We know how these things have gone over the last 2.5 years. It's been detected in the United States. In all likelihood, BA.2.75 is just a matter of time, or maybe it's potentially already here in California and we just don't know it yet.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the first two cases of BA.2.75 that were detected in the United States were detected in California. So we know it's here. We haven't detected it in Yolo County, but that doesn't mean that it's not here. But what we do know is from the extensive genotyping that was being done by the UC Davis Genome Center on positives through the end of June, that BA.5 is the variant that's causing the majority of cases now. And the reason why we're concerned about BA.5 in particular is because it's known for immune evasion. So that means people who are fully vaccinated and boosted are still getting infected, although those infections are milder than they would be if they were not vaccinated and boosted. So vaccination remains the best protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. I want to be really clear on that. But also seeing reinfections from BA.5 in people who have already and recently been infected with COVID. So the very large wave of cases that we had from the original Omicron, the BA.1 variants in January, those people are now getting reinfected with BA.5. So we're seeing cases in people who already had it and cases in people who are fully vaccinated. So it is quite a discouraging moment, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people were at the point in the pandemic where if you actually got COVID and you were vaccinated, you kind of thought maybe you had an extra booster, you had some immunity or some extra protection, at least for a few months. But now with the prevalency of getting reinfected, I mean, how recent are we talking? When you talk about Omicron, is this a January infection? Or are you seeing cases of people getting sick as close back as even last month and then getting reinfected?
Yeah, it's tricky when we talk about reinfections because the definition of a reinfection, according to the epidemiologists, they won't even consider someone a new case if less than 90 days has passed. So if you look at the formal reinfection data, you can't be a reinfection within 90 days of your first infection. But we are seeing some actual reinfections of people 1 to 2 months after a previous infection. So we aren't just talking people who had Omicron in January who are now susceptible to Omicron again. We're talking people who may have had Omicron 2 months ago who are getting BA.5 infections.
Wow, so that recent. I mean, when it comes to the booster situation, who is eligible for a second booster at this time?
Yeah, so at this time, second boosters are recommended and available for people over the age of 50 and anyone who has underlying conditions. And, you know, We've been talking about boosters for a while. We've been talking about second boosters for a while, and really want to remind people that vaccines are the best protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And the uptake of the second boosters in particular among older adults is much lower than we'd like to see. I was just looking at our Yolo County data, and only about a third of adults over the age of 50 have gotten a second booster. And this has been available for many months. So, you know, I know some people have been waiting for there to be a surge before they felt like they should get that second booster. Now is that time. Don't wait any longer. If you haven't gotten a second booster and it's been at least 4 months since your last dose, go get that booster. It absolutely could save your life.
What does it tell you that there are, I guess, the majority of people out there who've been vaccinated and received their first booster but are still waiting on getting that second booster?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is they may be trying to time it to an upcoming event or, you know, plan travel. And so they wanted to have peak immunity before going on an upcoming trip, for example. But I think, you know, with the increases that we've seen in case rates, but in particular increases in the wastewater, which is painting a more accurate picture of reality now than cases, and we can talk more about that. Now is not the time to wait to get that booster. You know, you want a booster timed so that you have immunity as the case rates are going up, and the case rates are going up. So now is the time to get that added protection. I think some of it is also pandemic fatigue, and people, you know, for the sake of their own mental health, have stopped tuning in to the daily and the hourly updates around the pandemic. And, you know, from the outside, things can look like they're functioning pretty normally. So it's important for us in public health, and with the support of you in the media, to get the word out when the situation changes. And the situation has changed. There is a lot of virus in the community right now. And so I, as the health officer in Yolo County, want to make sure that the public knows that there's a lot of virus in the community, and that it's important to take additional steps, like wearing a mask indoors, like getting that second booster, like getting your young child vaccinated if they're, you know, 6 months or older. Older, that's now, you know, newly eligible. So taking additional steps, because this is not, you know, the low virus levels that we were seeing a couple of months ago. This is wastewater levels that are as high, if not higher, than they were during the peak of the Omicron wave in January, when we had case rates in the 250s.
Can you explain to us how testing wastewater actually works in getting a more accurate picture of the prevalence of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is, you know, when we had accurate PCR testing and widespread PCR testing of the population, you know, we preferred to look to that and the case rates that come from that over the wastewater data. Particularly here in Yolo County, we had a very large testing program called Healthy Davis Together and Healthy Yolo Together that were doing PCR testing. In many cases, people were getting tested once a week, regular testing. That program ended on June 30th, and all of those PCR tests are no longer happening, which means the number of people getting tested in Yolo County just plummeted. And what we know is the fewer tests you do, the fewer cases you find. And so our case rate just went down from, you know, over the course of a couple of days, from 45 to 33. But nothing actually changed in the community. We still have really high virus transmission. So that is an artifact of reduced testing. And so because so many people are testing at home now with these wonderful antigen tests and getting results in 15 minutes, and I absolutely want people doing that, the challenge for us from a surveillance perspective in public health is that we don't get to see the results of those antigen tests. They don't show up in our case rates, which only include PCR tests. So there's a lot of cases that are happening in the community that don't show up in our data. So that's where wastewater surveillance comes in. The beauty of wastewater surveillance, it does not rely on somebody going and getting a PCR test or going online to report an antigen test. It just requires them using the restroom on a regular basis. And so we're able to look at the wastewater where everybody is submitting a specimen without trying on a regular basis. And we can say, oh, this trend over time, I can't say which individual individuals have COVID, but I can say in the community of Davis, where we've been doing wastewater surveillance for over a year, that now the levels are higher than they've ever been. That was two weeks ago. They've actually now come down to as high as they were in January, which is still very high. So that's why you're hearing a lot of talk about wastewater now, when before we pointed to case rates, because fewer people are testing, those case rates are inaccurate. Wastewater, everybody is testing, and so we get a more accurate picture.
When looking at the prevalency of the virus and even the test positivity rate in California, it's around 16%, which is high, but that is likely nowhere near the real number, as people are testing at home and not at a lab, as you just laid out. What do you think the real number is?
Yeah, I can't really speculate on that. Testing positivity is a function both of how much disease is in the community, as well as whether you have adequate testing or not. So you can influence testing positivity in two ways: by actually having increased transmission of the virus, or you can just test very few people, and that will also inflate your testing positivity, which is what we've seen in Yolo County over the last week. Since our testing volume plummeted, our testing positivity has gone up, but nothing has actually changed in the amount of virus spreading in the community. So,
right. Like more people getting tested because they actually are symptomatic, as opposed to just getting regularly tested regardless.
Right. Yeah. So it's hard to speculate what the actual positivity rate is, but I think, you know, particularly wastewater allows us to look at trends, and positivity is also useful for tracking the trends. And what we've seen statewide, where you have a relatively consistent testing volume, is that positivity is going way up, which is an indication that we're in a surge and that there's a lot of virus in the community and it's time to take additional precautions.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing are numbers are nothing without context. And the way that we have viewed a test positivity rate over the two plus years has evolved and changed. How do you view the test positivity rate now? And is this a metric that we should be using to base our level of concern, given that there are treatments, therapeutics, vaccines, and hospitalizations are climbing, but there's still capacity and deaths are low?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question and a good point. And we've seen in the metrics that the CDC is using, which now, of course, we are tracking in California and in Yolo County as well, is not just looking at the case rate and the testing positivity rate, but also looking at the impact on society and the impact on the healthcare system. Where we've really gotten into trouble with past surges is when you overwhelm your healthcare system because you either have too many patients or not enough healthcare providers, or a combination of both. And what we've seen so far in this current wave of cases is, while we've seen a lot of cases, we've seen high testing positivity, we haven't seen the significant impacts on the healthcare system like we did with the Delta wave and the Omicron wave. So that's sort of the silver lining of this BA.2.12.1 and BA.5 wave sort of superimposed on each other, is we haven't seen significant impacts on the healthcare system. But some of that is because we have treatments available like Paxlovid, where people who are at high risk of severe disease who test positive can start this pill within 5 days of their symptoms beginning, take it for 5 days, and they're 90% less likely to end up in the hospital. So it's not necessarily that these strains, BA.5 in particular, cause less severe disease. It's that we have better treatments in place to prevent hospitalization.
When it comes to someone who has been reinfected and they're vaccinated with their first booster, you talked about even the parameters for calling something a reinfection has to happen after 90 days of being infected the prior time. How long should someone wait after that reinfection to get the second booster?
Yeah, I used to encourage people to wait about 90 days after an infection before getting boosted, because that infection itself can serve as a booster dose. But I think, you know, now with the variants that we have that are escaping immunity, any additional boost that you can get from a vaccine, in addition to the booster that you get from infection, is important. So I no longer advise people to wait after an infection for 90 days before getting their booster. You're eligible for a booster as soon as you've recovered from your infection. So that would be, at least 10 days have passed and you don't have a fever and you're feeling better, you can then go in and get your booster. And that's what I would advise it at this point, is not waiting 3 months. But once you've recovered from your infection, if you aren't up to date with vaccination, to get that booster, because it will give you additional protection against future infection.
We're talking about people 50 and over. On the flip side, pediatric vaccines have expanded to include babies and toddlers. How is that rolling out in Yolo County?
It's a little bit of a slow start, but I will say, I'm trying to think, I think we've had over 700 children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years who have gotten vaccinated in the, week and a half since we've been offering the vaccine in Yolo County to the youngest kids. It's about 6.5% of our population that's between 6 months and 5 years, and that's a higher rate than that population is getting vaccinated statewide, which was around 2-something%. Sorry, I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head. But we would like to see more parents bringing their kids in. I think it's important for parents who aren't sure whether vaccination is right for their child at this time to have a conversation with their healthcare provider who can answer their questions. But I will say that, COVID-19 can cause serious illness in children. It can cause serious illness in children who don't have underlying conditions. So this false impression that many people have that COVID is always a mild illness in children is not true. COVID is the fourth or fifth leading cause of death in children in the United States, and we have a safe and effective vaccine that can keep kids out of the hospital. So I strongly recommend parents get their children vaccinated. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine are excellent and safe choices, and I would not delay.
Schools are going to be going back into session, in just about a month or so from now. This will be the third school year in a pandemic. What are you doing in Yolo County to prep schools, and what's going to be different?
Yeah, the California Department of Public Health just last week released its updated K through 12 schools guidance for the 2022-2023 academic year. So we've been working to communicate with our schools, and starting with our superintendents, what's new in that guidance, which isn't very much actually, and what's staying the same, what the requirements are. But essentially, the minor shifts in this guidance for the next school year primarily align what we do in schools with what we do in the rest of the community, to try to be consistent across sectors. So if we aren't requiring masks in the general community, we won't be requiring them in K through 12 schools. But no one thing that's very clear in the K through 12 schools guidance is that nobody who wants to wear a mask can be prohibited from wearing a mask, and that a school needs to have masks available for students who want to wear them. So I know masking was, one of the more controversial components of the K through 12 schools guidance over the last couple of years. But CDPH has made it clear that masking guidance for schools for this next academic year will align with masking guidance for the general community, which I think makes a lot of sense.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Yolo County Health Officer Dr. Amy Sisson about the latest on the summer COVID surge. Let's just dive right into this because we've been tap dancing around it. Let's talk about COVID fatigue. We are 2.5 years into this. In the past, a 16% positivity rate may have triggered masking mandates, closures of indoor dining, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think people, broadly speaking, take your advice as a public health officer seriously anymore? And is it frustrating if they don't?
Yeah, I think, as you pointed out, pandemic fatigue is is real. And it has been a challenging last few years with the pandemic. I think, a lot of people for multiple reasons are not listening as closely as they were to public health. But there are some people who are still tuning in very closely. And so I think we need a sort of a mixed messaging strategy. We don't want to overwhelm people, but we also want a way when things change, like they are now, when the case rates are going up, when the wastewater level is going up, a way to get an alert out to the community to say, look, we know you're mostly over COVID, but you really should pay attention right now because things are different. The risk is higher than it's ever been, and here's things you can do, like wearing a mask indoors, like testing and staying home when you're sick, staying up to date with vaccination that can keep you safe. So I think it's challenging to be on, the side of trying to get a message out when fewer people are listening. But I think we also potentially need to get more creative in how we send our messages. We've really relied on people being active consumers of information, or when it was headlining the nightly news every night, they could still be a passive consumer and they were just being hammered from 50,000 directions. And so they would hear the message of there's a lot of COVID, you should wear your mask. And when you entered every grocery store, there was a sign that said you have to wear your mask and somebody's standing there making sure you put your mask on. We aren't in that phase of the pandemic anymore, yet we still need to find ways to get messages out to people who aren't active consumers of information. And I've been chatting with folks in the community, and some have pitched some what I think are really promising ideas where we potentially partner with the community grocery stores, for example, with standard signage that say, COVID risk level, much like CDC has red, yellow, green. And when we're in red, we communicate to the grocery stores, put out your red sign that says, look, the risk level is really high. We strongly recommend that you put a mask on before you come into this store. It's not going to be a requirement, but for people who aren't tracking the news and listening to Insight on a regular basis, that they can hear or see the fact that the case rate's high and this is what public health is recommending. And they didn't have to go out of their way to consume that information. So that's just one idea as we're going back to the drawing board, because the methods that I think we've been using to communicate aren't as accessible to people anymore. And we need to be a bit more creative in how we get the word out about the fact that we are at very high community transmission right now.
Yeah, we're talking about an evolution from society to even how you work as a public health officer. 2.5 years since or into COVID, we're still very much in it. What has surprised you about this disease?
I think the fact that it continues to surprise us surprises me. I think we continue to be humbled by how much this virus mutates. And I was just reading an article. We normally think about evolution occurring, on this scale of eons and millennia, and we're seeing evolution happening right before our eyes over a month when it comes to COVID variants. And so I think, as a health officer who was a new health officer at the beginning of the pandemic, has never served in a pandemic before, I
In a
think
different
that's been
county,
the
too.
and yes, I think that's been the biggest surprise to me is just when you think you understand SARS-CoV-2 virus and the variant that we're dealing with, then a new one comes along and we're constantly having to shift and pivot. And just like for the public, that's exhausting. I think we all would like to see this pandemic end and move towards an endemic phase where we have, significantly fewer cases. But, this virus, through its evolution, has other plans.
Finally, we have you back on in 6 months from now. What are we talking about in terms of COVID?
I would
That
love
puts
to
us to the er
say,
that puts us to early 2023, but after the new year.
yeah, I would love to say that we're talking about COVID recovery and mental health and the impacts that COVID had on mental health and how we've implemented so many new programs to address that. I also think that we're going to be talking about long COVID. The estimates are that 20% of people who have been infected with COVID have long COVID or post-COVID disease. And so I think even if we've moved past the acute phase of the pandemic and are in a more endemic phase, we'll still be talking about the mental health impacts of COVID and also long COVID.
Dr. Sisson, thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And that is Dr. Amy Sisson, the public health officer for Yolo County. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.